Welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and at KUCI.org. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and business of writing. And the views expressed are not those of the university regents, but those of my own and my guests, and if we ever have call-ins, and anyway, they belong to us, not the university. Today, my guest is Betsy Lerner. She received an MFA from Columbia University. She was a co-editor of Columbia's literary magazine and a founder of the now-defunct underground magazine Big Wednesday. She has won a Thomas Wolfe Poetry Prize and an Academy of American Poets Poetry Prize and was named by American Pen as one of three emerging writers in 1987. She's also received a Simon & Schuster Fellowship and the Tony Godwin Fellowship for Editors. She worked in the editorial departments at Simon & Schuster, Ballantyne, and Houghton Mifflin. Finally, as an executive editor at Doubleday before becoming an agent with the Gernert Company in New York City. Welcome, Betsy.
Oh, thank you.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Will you talk about how you made the transition from actually being a poet to an editor and then an agent?
Well, the transition from poet to editor was sort of easy. I needed a job, and I had no faith in actually making a living as a poet, getting published and, you know, teaching at Iowa. That would have been great, but I didn't see that happening. So I discovered while I was in graduate school that I had a great love of editing. I edited the magazine there, and I also worked part-time for a literary agent, which sort of introduced me to the world of publishing and manuscripts and authors, and I loved it. So I was fortunate. I got a fellowship from Simon & Schuster while I was in graduate school, and that ensured me at least a job for 1 year when I finished as an editorial assistant, and that that was the beginning.
So then you were an editor for how many years?
13 years.
And then what made you go into agenting?
Well, first I probably should say that I always had kind of an interest in agenting, and agents had always had an interest in me because I actually liked developing projects from the seed stage. You know, I like discovering writers myself in magazines and all sorts of places, and I had a lot of ideas for books, so I was always sort of generating ideas, and that was one piece of it, though I really loved being an editor, so I didn't consider crossing the line, as we say. But after more than a dozen years and certain, I guess, professional frustrations, to be completely honest, along with my own burgeoning writing career, turning 40, having a child, all of these things, all of these things conspired to say, you know, when the opportunity to agent with the man I'm agenting with came about, I thought, you know, this is really the best possible situation. You could embark on this career, and maybe this is the right time. I did it with a lot of trepidation and a lot of excitement.
Wow. Well, your book, Forest for the Trees, An Editor's Advice to Writers, is really quite interesting in you're giving your perspective from the point of view of an editor as well as an agent. Was this book a long time in coming? I mean, were you thinking of this for quite a while, or did it begin when you transition to being an agent?
Oh, no, I actually wrote every word of it while I was still an editor. Mm-hmm. About 2 days later, I resigned. But the book actually started in my mind as an idea at least 10 years ago when I was an associate editor and I was writing what's called a tip sheet, which are these one sheets we do on all the titles we publish, mm-hmm. for a book called No Bad Dogs. By Barbara Woodhouse.
I know that book.
You know that book. So you know her philosophy, which is there are no bad dogs, only bad owners.
Right.
And I thought immediately that really there were no bad authors, only editors who failed to prepare and train their authors for the publishing experience. Because I was always hearing all this shop talk about how authors were bad, and authors were needy, and authors were unruly and ungrateful and demanding, and, you know, people kind of had all these disparaging comments about authors, and I would try to tell my authors what they needed to do so that they would become pets, you know, and beloved in the house, and not be somebody people would want to jump under their desk when they saw them coming, but rather someone they wanted to make that extra phone call for, or, you know, go that extra mile, which is all about, you know, how books become successful. And I thought, I'm going to write a parody called No Bad Writers. And I schlepped that book with me in a blank notebook on probably every vacation I went on for the next 10 years and never did it. And eventually I got married, and my husband always thought the idea was stupid and that I shouldn't write a parody. I should write my real thoughts and feelings about authors' personalities, because at that, by then, I had developed so many theories about their characters. And that's how it started. And then, unbelievably enough, one vacation with my book, I did always bring it with me, I started the proposal. And immediately, within four sentences, I no longer had any interest in it as a parody. And it started to, you know, emerge as a full-blown idea about writers' characters and their work and how one impacted on the other.
It's interesting, in the first part of the book, you describe a few of the different types of writers, the ambivalent writer, the natural, the wicked child, the self-promoter, the neurotic. And are there more? Or well, are these what you see as the archetypes?
Well, yes, there are always variations on the theme. And embedded in each chapter is also the opposite. So, you know, in addition to the self-promoter, you will also get the self-saboteur, as I like to call them. In addition to the natural, you get the person who is just an incredibly hard worker, but maybe doesn't have as much native talent. The wicked child is juxtaposed with the good child, you know, the person who I think protects others by censoring or silencing themselves. But of course, actually, the book started out with 24 chapters, and now there are 12 and mm-hmm. six types. And I guess I found that a lot of the other types I had originally thought I would write about were just variations on the ones that I eventually boiled it all down to.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM. My guest is Betsy Lerner, author of The Forest for the Trees, an editor's advice to writers. How does having the experience as an editor influence your role as an agent?
Well, my experience as an editor cuts both ways. On the one hand, I think I have a very keen understanding of how the process works from the inside, both in acquiring a new project and then eventually how it's positioned and sold and publicized. I worked at four houses, so I really have a broad range of I've sat at a lot of tables, at a lot of conference room tables, watching how books were shaped and ready for the marketplace. On the other hand, it probably makes me maybe a tad too sensitive to everything as well. And, you know, I have my own strong creative ideas about how things should happen for books. And, you know, while that enables me to be a good advocate, you know, sometimes maybe I don't have the distance that another agent might have.
Although I'm sure writers love you for it.
I hope so. I think so.
I heard from a friend today, Beth Keppert, who has been on the show a couple of times, and apparently her manuscript, I don't know if it was a slant of Sun or the Tangled Web of Friendship, I'm sure I have that title wrong, but somehow her manuscript found its way through your office, and she didn't give me any details, but she just said you were very sweet. And it's a compliment from a writer, or from anyone, I'm sure, but, you know, writers are always sort of frustrated with the people they're dealing with in publishing, it seems.
Well, there's a big gap, and I think a lot of writers feel hurt or betrayed or neglected by agents and editors when their work isn't taken up or taken as seriously as they would like. And what I like to try to tell writers is that if you're being rejected right and left, then probably you need to go back to work and you need more help in the form of a writing group or a course or something like that. You can't really look to the publishing and agenting community to educate you or to nurture you along. I mean, it just, you know, every now and then you hear about an editor and agent who finds somebody, you know, diamond in the rough and really puts the time in and helps them because they believe in them. I have a couple of clients like that myself, but I'm only going to do that once in a blue moon because obviously I couldn't function and do my job well if I did that with every writer who I thought had potential. Everybody has potential, but you go with those few works you feel keenly, deeply, madly passionate about because it's so difficult. You know, it's a very difficult business for all of us. Even if you are at the top of the heap, you're a publisher, you're still struggling to get your books attention and sold and all the rest of it.
Speaking of rejections, which you mentioned a few minutes ago, interpreting rejections is an interesting process as well. Say you are submitting a query letter to an agent, or even the agent is submitting material to a publisher, and the rejections come back that sound very positive, and yet they don't want it. Mm-hmm. What do you do in that respect? I mean, it may not be that you need class. You may need something, but the interpretation of rejections is a tough one, I think, for writers to know exactly how to take it, since you rarely get any details. You know, they might say, compelling writing, crowded shelf. Mm-hmm. And you look at that and you say, what does this mean?
That's very, very difficult. Close but no cigar. I like you, but I don't love you. you know, I love you, but I don't want to get in bed with you. You know, I mean, it's very, very difficult to handle those or to understand those rejections. But I sometimes tell people there's two, you know, there are two responses. There's yes and there's no. And that's it. You know, unless somebody is really specific and willing to take you through the revision, that close but no cigar, it's just still a no. And so you've got to either keep trying until you find the person who loves it, if you're one of those people who has the stamina to send it out 20 times, or you put it aside and you move on to the next work, which will undoubtedly be better than the work you've just completed, because so much of this is apprenticeship and craft and experience. And many of the first novels that we read are really somebody's fifth novel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's very hard. I never will want to tell a person, you know what, try 10 times and then quit, because we all know of the stories where it was the 21st submission that got you in. And if all of the people are coming close, that to me would be a motivator to keep trying. But at the end of the day, you know, you can't walk through a closed door. And you're not gonna really do yourself, you know, any good by, you know, whether, you know, becoming bitter or angry or sort of turning on the whole process. I mean, I see a lot of that, and it's very heartbreaking.
Well, how many times will you as an agent send something out? Does it have to do with the work and how much you love it? Does it have to do with the types of rejections coming in?
Well, so far I've sent, the most number of times is about 25.
Mm.
And I did find a publisher. You know, because I feel once I've taken it on, then now it's not just my author's art, it's my professionalism that's on the line, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I don't want to fail. So, and I'm willing to, you know, I'm willing to go to a small press and get an offer of $5,000. You know, I mean, if the author still wants me to keep trying, that is.
Sure.
Sometimes we'll pull something back after 5 or 10 rejections, and we'll work on it some more. But once I've sent it out, I mean, I really feel it's good to go. And
now, does this have to do with the fact that you take only the things you really, really believe in, as opposed to perhaps a huge agency or an agent with lots of sub-agents who are just going to take as much as they can and see what sticks?
You know, people say that there are these so-called spaghetti agents who will do that. I don't really know of any. I mean, in my experience, when a person takes on a client, if it's a reputable agency, and the big agencies, too, they don't just churn it out. They're only big because they have a lot of clients, but they have a lot of agents and a lot of people to do the support staff. for that work. They're not big because they just take anything and throw it out there. I think most agents, when they take on a book, believe that they can absolutely believe that they can sell it. And certainly sometimes they don't sell it, but I think that's always a very, you know, that's a very painful moment and very painful call that you have to make to your client. Maybe some people take it lightly, but in my experience as an editor, all the agents I knew were as serious as heart attacks about their submissions.
Hmm. In your book, you talk about talent versus mediocrity, or rather how talent is not an assurance that success will follow, but it takes other qualities as well, or maybe more so. Would you elaborate on that?
Well, in the book, I sort of talk about it as the Walt Whitman versus the Emily Dickinson syndrome, where he was a great self-promoter. Of course, he was also a great poet, but he was shameless in his self-promotion, really. And she, of course, you know, we all know, could barely leave the house or send anything out in an envelope. And, you know, I think that most writers kind of fall along that continuum. You do see people who are just not that good, who are incredibly good at networking, and other people who are really terrific who, you know, just can't put themselves out there in any kind of way that makes the publishing community or the literary community interested in them. And, you know, I guess what I try to help people with in the book is to marshal whatever resources you do have and work with the problem areas. Don't let them completely, you know, destroy your career. Find ways, you know, around it, whether it's intense shyness or, you know, low self-esteem, whatever, to get your work out there. I mean, and ultimately, what is talent? You know, who knows? You know, who knows why people love one writer and are not interested in reading another? You know, these are matters of taste. They're very subjective. What's popular, what's literary, what's intellectual, you know, these are all interesting concepts, you know, and I don't know. I never actually answered that question of, you know, is there real talent versus people who just, you know, work hard until they break through.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest is Betsy Lerner, a New York literary agent and author of The Forest for the Trees, an editor's advice to writers. In the book, you also talk about late bloomers, and I know of writers who create a timeline for themselves. If they don't make it, say, by, age 30 or 40, they're going to quit. What would you say to these writers, or what do you say?
Well, I guess A, define make it, you know, and then B, so what? You know, I mean, you're going to quit? Who cares? I mean, if you are a writer, you're never going to quit. You're always going to write, whether you're just writing your own diaries or beautiful letters or books that you shelve away. If you're a writer, you simply have to write because that's, you know, really the only way you can live in the world, whether or not you're published or not. I mean, I think one can say, I will give writing my full-time attention for X many years, but then I'm going to do something because I want to be able to support myself, because one does have to support oneself, and very few people, very few writers can. But I don't know. I mean, I stopped writing for 12 years, and I made a vow to never bitch about it because I sort of thought, who, you know, did anyone really care that I wasn't writing another mediocre poem? I don't think so. You know, the world does not cry out for the pages somebody does not write.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound too mean?
No. I think we do get caught up in what they want as opposed to what we need to do. And I think that's right on. I think you have to do it ultimately because you want to or have to or you don't.
Yeah, I mean, I just sold a first book by a woman who is 60. And earlier this year, I sold a first book by a man in his mid-50s. You know, and they've been writing their whole lives.
Well, that brings up another question that I'm always interested in, and that is ageism. It exists in, say, Hollywood to some degree with screenwriters and writers for episodic TV. Does it exist in publishing?
Oh, sure. I mean, people really love the hot young thing. They love it. The juicy, young, gorgeous thing. you know, that said, they also really like terrific writing. You know, and a lot of those people who, you know, publish, you know, they're very young, they're precocious, they're gorgeous, whatever. They get a lot of money, fame, and attention, and then they disappear too, because you know the writing life, she ain't an easy ride. You know, there are so few who started really young and continue to go up, 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 like say Truman Capote. But then look what happened there too. You know, total devastation, alcoholism, etc. Philip Roth is like one of the few examples, though he, of course, also had a famous, you know, breakdown at some point in his writing. But it's very difficult to maintain your life as a career writer. But I think no matter what age you are, if you have produced something of real beauty, of real worth, of real interest, you will get it published.
What about the market then? Writers sometimes are thinking a little too much about what's selling and what they should write as opposed to what they want to write.
That is very true. People get kind of caught up in trends. And it's funny. I mean, I remember when the first Krakauer book took off Into Thin Air. And actually, his previous book also did very well, Into the Wild.
Mm-hmm.
And then we saw a spate of books about, you know, climbing these huge mountains, et cetera. And I thought to myself, well, these are never going to work. These are just Johnny-come-latelys and, you know, coattail publishing. And, well, needless to say, the category has been so resilient. And everybody is buying up these books, and they're all, many of them are really working very well in the marketplace. So, you know, sometimes I guess a trend is more than a trend. It's really speaking to some sort of larger desire in the marketplace. But I don't think you could go out and write one of those books just because you thought it was going to sell anyway unless you had the goods. And therefore I say, you know, just do what it is you're meant to do. Write what your obsession is. Write in the form that you are meant to write in. Don't, you know, you're really, I think, you know, not going to be very successful in a copycat mode unless it really was your thing to begin with.
Talking about actually projects and projects that you are interested in, what sort of things do you represent? What do you love to see come in the door?
I love memoir. I love books that are sort of psychologically or anthropologically based, any sort of nonfiction subject that sort of takes its subject apart. Everybody talks about narrative nonfiction, but there's also another kind of nonfiction that, you know, builds on a subject in a way that isn't necessarily narrative that I really like, that's sort of thematic. I like strong narrative nonfiction as well. Obviously, everybody does. I'm interested in books that have a feminist or a political spine or agenda. I mostly do nonfiction, and I'm very curious. But it's always the writing that gets me and the voice that gets me more than, you know, the subject. I am known, I will confess, as the pain and suffering editor. I was known as that because I've done a lot. I am interested in books about sort of not just painful experiences, but experiences people have where they're really challenged to the core. I recently sold a book and have seen its publication called Augusta Gone, which describes a mother's experience with her 15-year-old daughter who's become really a truant and a nightmare, and how she dealt with that. And what appealed to me in that book was, you know, the honesty of the voice, the candor. I thought she kind of opened up a whole new layer in that, you know, pretty well-covered category.
Interesting. All right, we're going to take a very short break. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more Betsy Lerner. And when we come back, we'll talk about how she likes writers to make contact. So please stay tuned. Welcome back to Writers on Writing. And we're here with Betsy Lerner, author of The Forest for the Trees and Editor's Advice to Writers. And it's published by Riverhead Books. Betsy.
Yes.
Tell us how you like writers to get in contact with you.
Well, I'm a little old-fashioned. I don't really like email queries, though I do respond to them. I prefer a letter and either the proposal with it or the first 50 to 75 pages of the novel. And I like the letter to be smart, concise, engaging, pertinent. Often when I go to writers' conferences, we spend tons of time on what's the perfect query letter, as if this were the, you know, key to the kingdom. And in a way it is, because if you're a writer, you know, you should be able to write a good query letter. And what a good query letter isn't going to be the same thing for to every agent, but there is something sort of universally loved about a smart, charming letter, you know, that's just to the point. And so many people write query letters that are just long and rambling and full of recommendations from the author's mother or friends. And, you know, you can't believe the tack that, you know, various people take trying to get your attention, lots of false flattery. It's sometimes sending trinkets, gifts, chocolates, things like this. It's really weird. You know, in a really good, succinct, interesting letter, almost anybody will at least read the next few pages and see if this is something for them.
What does happen when you get a gimmick of some sort, whether it be chocolates or a cup? Or what do you do with that? Do you pay the same kind of attention to it, or do you just throw it out?
I almost dismiss. I mean, I do throw out the gimmick immediately. I would never, though I love chocolate, would eat chocolate sent to me by a stranger. And a little paranoid, too, I guess. But I don't really take it very seriously. I mean, I'll still eyeball the letter, but no, it doesn't. It's not really impressive unless it's something just so germane and lovely to the project itself. It just would be of no interest, and I think it's very unprofessional.
How many queries do you receive a week?
I probably get, you know, somewhere between 3 to 6 a day, so somewhere around 20 to 25.
And of those, how influential is it if the query comes from someone who is recommended by, say, a client or somebody you know, and will that make all the difference, or does it still really come down to whether it's engaging?
It still comes down to that. If a client refers somebody to me, you know, and sometimes the client writes you and says, oh, this person cornered me at a party. I'm so sorry. I gave them your name. Or sometimes they'll email you or mail you, you know, call you and say, this is one of the best students' writing I've ever seen. Please, you know, take a look at it. And, yeah, you definitely pay attention to that. But by the same token, that's all you do is, you know, either put it on the top of your stack or look at it more quickly. You know, you still have to connect with the work, which doesn't, by the same token, doesn't mean the work is good or bad. It's just, you know, did this particular agent connect with this particular piece of writing?
Mm-hmm. And then of those queries, how many of those might result in clients?
Well, I don't know, maybe 10. A year, 15 a year.
Mm-hmm. So the odds are are stacked.
The odds are stacked.
In terms of the writing, now, say somebody is approaching you with a memoir project or creative nonfiction, and it's a stylistic piece. Do you want the query to be in the style, or does the style still come through, or the writer still come through regardless? You know, I mean, a query is to my way of thinking a little more businesslike than,
mm-hmm. Right.
You know, than the writing.
Right. Yeah, no, the query should be businesslike. However, it doesn't have to be stiff. You know, this isn't, you aren't approaching me as a lawyer or something. You know, I am a creative person. I respond to language. And, you know, its clever use is a good idea. But, you know, that said, I think, you know, anything that you think might be too clever is too clever. And it's better to be straightforward and just say, you know, thank you for looking at my memoir X. The first chapter will be published in Redbook, you know, or something that would really make me think, oh, wow, you know. And if you don't have any good credential like that, you should think about getting one, because that'll also really, really help you. I know so many writers who say, you know, I'm thinking about doing this as a book, and I'll say, well, why don't you try to do it as an article first? No, I really don't want to. And you sort of think, wait a minute, you'd like to do this as a full-length 300-page book, but you don't even can't get it up for a, you know, 8,000-word article? This makes no sense. And if you wrote it as an article and you actually got it into Good Housekeeping or Redbook or Harper's or somewhere, you know, there's a good chance an agent, upon reading it, would call you.
Sure.
And God knows what a great feeling that would be for somebody trying to break in.
Mm-hmm. Well, aside from the credentials of that sort, when you then have the project in front of you, you have a few pages of the proposal, you have the proposal, how much of it do you need to look at to know whether it's for you? I mean, say the query comes in, just the query, and you say, yeah, I'd like to see this, and then the proposal comes in. Will you look at the whole thing, or do you just know pretty quickly in looking at the writing and the pages and the intro?
I think we all just know. Mm-hmm. And again, it's not about good or bad necessarily, but is it right for me?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a reason why my husband will put on a piece of jazz and I'll say, turn that shit off, you know, and he loves it. You know, he hears it. I don't get it. You know, and it's the same thing about writing, which is why writers really need to develop that really super thick skin, to be cliched, when it comes to rejections. Because just because, you know, I don't like it really doesn't have any bearing on whether or not, you know, you should continue pursuing it.
Yes. Speaking of thick skin, in your book you talk about exposing yourself and writing what you need to write, regardless of how you feel your parents will feel about it. Will you talk a bit about that?
You know, of course, it's a great question. It comes at a very timely moment because I'm actually working on a memoir right now, and I sort of face that. You know, I'll be writing, and then my mother will call that night and say, how are you doing? And I'm saying, okay. I feel so guilty, even though the point of the book is not to skewer her necessarily. But, yeah, I think that a lot of writers are holding back because of what, if not their parents, then maybe their spouses or, you know, inner circle might think. And that's reasonable. You have to live with these people. On the other hand, I think that to really be a great writer in some ways is simply to be savage. And that's not to say to savage the people you love, but to do whatever it is you have to do to make your book true and real and powerful. And, you know, if you're going to have half measures here and half measures there, you're going to have a watered-down work at the end of the day. And I think a lot of these books that are like people like them but don't love them, they're good but not good enough, my guess is that those authors are camouflaging and hiding and, you know, somehow avoiding some deep sort of powerful truth that needs to happen in their book.
Interesting.
Just a theory.
Sure. Yeah, well, that's a good one. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM. My guest is Betsy Lerner, a New York literary agent and author of The Forest for the Trees and Editor's Advice to Writers. Your title is catchy. And how important to you are titles when writers are proposing projects? And do you often recommend that a title be changed?
Yeah, I'm a I think the title is one of the most important pieces of a work, not just in a marketing sense, but that's also important. I think the title, and maybe this comes from my training as poet, it's a great signifier of the entire work. And a great title will signify the entire work. And you will both not really know what it means or sort of think you know what it means and be attracted to it when you first pick up the book, but when you finish the book, it'll be emblazoned in your brain forever because it's so perfect. And I worked very hard with my, as an editor and now as an agent, to try to find those titles that really sum up the book in the fullest sense possible. Some people will tell you titles don't matter that much at all, jackets don't matter that much at all, but I think if you're a deep book lover, those elements are as important as the words almost.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, yeah, there are certain and book covers that you just want them out. You need the book because you love how it looks.
Mm-hmm.
It's the whole package. It's mm-hmm. not, you're just, all you care about is what's inside. It's true.
Yeah, and the aesthetic of it, it's all been brought together. And not just the title, but the typeface that was selected for the title, the typeface that was selected for the interior. There's such a great art that is so often neglected and not talked about, which is book design and its history, which is fascinating. And the designers of the companies I worked for were the coolest people, the coolest people. And their sensitivity to visual and verbal, you know, came together in the selection of typefaces and fonts and all the rest of it. I think they were just amazing.
How influential can you be or can writers be when it comes to the packaging? Does it depend on the author and the project and the publisher and all of those different elements for the most part?
Yeah, I mean, you know, nobody's going to piss Michael Crichton off with a bad jacket or Mary Higgins Clark. You know, these people get total approval, I'm sure. When you're a first-time author with a modest advance, you know, you can't expect to get approval. You can hope for consultation, which only means that they show it to you. Hopefully, if you have a good relationship with your editor, you can express your thoughts and ideas about the jacket, and that person can effectively communicate them and come up with something. And then every now and then there's serendipity where you just get an art director who fell in love with the book and picked the perfect artist to render something. And but they do a lot of titles a year, and, you know, a lot are mediocre, and some are great. And some houses are known for better packages than others.
Hmm. You mentioned a while ago, before the break, of occasionally going to small presses to get a deal for someone. And I'm curious if there's ever a point that a small press will not make it. I mean, if a small press is just too small, or if it's some faction of a publishing company that is just not going to get reviewed and it's just not worth it? Or is it just basically worth it no matter what to get your book in book form with any publisher?
Hey, we can take that a step further. There are people who self-publish.
Right.
You know,
that was my next question.
my hat is off to them. You know, I mean, that's really the person that's just going for broke and believes so fiercely in their work that no amount of rejection would stop them. And then there are these great stories. I outline a few of them in the book, like Elin Harris, who first self-published, brought his book to beauty parlors, where he knew the women would love his book and talk about it. And sure enough, he built up a local following, and a book rep from Doubleday discovered one of these copies and brought it to the home office, you know, and the rest is history. He's a New York Times national bestseller. Other people, one of the most touching stories I read was of a family who did a self-published book called How the Jester Lost His Jingle in memory of their son who had died of leukemia.
Sure.
And that book was also picked up. I mean, people have all kinds of reasons for self-publishing, and, you know, you couldn't self-publish 50 years ago. You know, forget it. Type and all that was way too expensive. Now you can actually do it and put those copies of the book in your car and hit the road, or you know, promote yourself on the internet or whatever. And I kind of applaud people who, I mean, it's nutty. You know, you've got to really be a little nutty to go for it at that level. But those people who do, I totally applaud them, because they're not really they're more interested in getting the word out. That's why they're writing.
What about publishing on, say, iUniverse or, publish on print on demand?
Mm-hmm. You know, I know one author who's done Ex Libris,
mm-hmm.
self-published, and for her it's really useful because she couldn't get this particular book published, which was on writing. She gives a lot of classes on writing, so every class she can order another 20, another 30, and have them right there for her students. That's very, useful to her, and she feels satisfied. She put all her thoughts down from years of teaching. And, maybe someday something will happen and somebody else will want to take it up in a larger way. I think these are all opportunities. You know, I don't know if I would necessarily recommend it in every instance, but when it seems like the right or best or only way to go and you still want to do it, I say why not.
Mm. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM and at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest is Betsy Lerner, New York literary agent and author of The Forest for the Trees, an editor's advice to writers, published by Riverhead Books. Do you want to give contact information of how people can contact you?
Well, I work at The Gernert Company, G-E-R-N-E-R-T, and that's in New York City, and we're in the phone book.
Okay. Gosh, we have a few minutes left, and I have a ton of things still. I'm curious how you balance your own writing with being an agent.
Well, I find it easier than when I was an editor, quite frankly. So I have more flexibility in my schedule, and I do still do a lot of reading and editing for my clients, but it's not quite as intense. So... That's one part of it. But the other part of it for me really is that this is all I want to do now. So I have almost no social life. Most of my friends hate me. I don't even get to watch my favorite TV shows. You know, I put my kid to bed and I go up to my office and I wake up at, you know, ungodly hours and go into my office. And I just sort of write in every waking hour that's not devoted to my clients or raising my child.
Mm-hmm.
I've just cut way back in what I don't go to parties. I don't, you know, I've really scaled my life back.
Will you talk about a bit about the motivation of writers who do succeed?
Well, I think success is its best motivator, really. And I think that most people who are successful at anything usually, you know, had some encouragement at a youngish age and then maybe won a prize or further encouraged. And it goes like that. I think a lot of, you know, really successful writers who, you know, work, who are prolific, it's really become almost second nature to them, maybe. You know, they just, I imagine that Stephen King, for the number of pages he puts out, probably is writing something like 20-something pages a day. You know, most people will tell you 2 pages. Personally, my personal best was 15. But, you know, I couldn't write 15 pages every day. I do know that. Maybe I could. Maybe I'm kidding myself. But I do think if you are extremely successful and you're making your career out of it and you're writing you're writing a book a year, then, you know, it has become your day job, when in fact for most people writing cannot be their day job.
Yes, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, and maybe not so unfortunately. I don't know.
Do you revise a lot?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I mean, as somebody who has studied poetry, I think I prefer revising than the actual, what I call, cracking it out of myself. Yeah, I think I'm a total reviser.
And is it as you go along, or do you wait till you have an entire draft before you even fiddle with it?
I have a first draft. I mean, I do as I go along, but it's more like warming up, doing, you know, editing the last few pages before I get going again. It's like a little warm-up thing. But I had such a terrible thing happen to me in college. My final paper, I rewrote a Milton paper about 40,000 times and then almost, you know, flunked out. because I kept writing the first paragraph over and over again. And after that, I'm telling you, it was really like Jack Nicholson in The Shining. I never allowed myself the luxury of revising until I was done.
Hmm.
And even flap copy, even catalog copy, when I had to write those things as a young editor, and I was petrified that I was going to freeze up and not be able to write it. And then I thought, that's it. Just sit down and do it. Don't look back. You can always fix it.
Hmm.
And I still am that way. It's out of total fear and anxiety,
mm-hmm.
not discipline.
So if you have ideas then for, I should do this with the first chapter, with the second chapter, will you just simply make notes, or will you go back to that page and make notes in the margin, or what will you do?
Well, there are some things that in my mind I would not ever forget. Like, I know I have something right now in chapter 4 that belongs in chapter 3, and I just know it. But when I'm sitting there and just tinkering, yeah, I'll make little notes about words or, you know, smooth out a sentence or whatever. But I don't know. I do think I am very lucky in that for all those years I spent as an editor, I actually can look at my work, so long as it's at least, you know, a few months old, and be pretty cold about it and know what to do.
What does that take? Is that something you learn because you're an editor, or is it something you can learn or discipline yourself to do?
I do think most writers show their work too soon and try to revise it too soon. I always went by Truman Capote, who said he took six weeks before he looked at anything he wrote, because then he had enough distance to have almost forgotten it and to be able to, you know, look at it with a colder eye. And also, I mean, I think, too, all those years that I was attempting writing but not really writing, I just, I kept revising, but I really wasn't working. I don't know how to explain it. But I think once you've got a lot of pages, you don't care about cutting a bunch of them. But when you only have a few pages, if you cut a bunch of them, you have nothing. And so you're much more protective of it, when really it doesn't deserve to be protected, not necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. That's one thing I learned with my first book, that once I really had a decent amount of pages, I could let many, many go.
That's a good point. Where's the future of publishing? What do you see happening? Do you see more online types of stuff going on, more self-publishing?
I think people are already bored with the Internet, actually, in some ways. And I don't think that if you want to read for pleasure, you want to read on a computer, though that may change, but I don't see that changing. I don't know. I really don't know. I have no idea. I don't like those questions, because you know what? I cling to the past, and I you know, barely am okay in the present. Future is just, I can't even believe I've made it this far.
I can relate. Yeah, the thought of books going away, whenever anybody has brought that up, it's like, oh, come on. You know, we can't cuddle up with an e-book or a Palm Pilot or something. You know, it's not going to happen.
You know, I was just on a panel with this older gentleman who talked about when cars came into being and people said that nobody would use horses anymore. And he said it's true that we don't use horses in the same way, but now they're just bred for excellence and speed and grace, and we love them as things of beauty. And so, you know, obviously making the parallel to books, you know, maybe there will come a time when everything we need to know that's information-based will be on the computer, but I still think that a book of poetry or a novel or whatever is, you know, just going to be, maybe it'll be more rare, but maybe it'll be more beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. We have another minute left. What words of wisdom would you like to impart here, apart from everything else we've talked about, and apart from all the wonderful stuff that's in your book?
Well, I guess from the publishing point of view, I would have to say that the only person who can ultimately reject you or stop you from writing is yourself. And don't let any, you know, person or publisher stop you from that goal if it's what you really believe you must do, and if it is what you are in fact doing. That's what I would say.
All right. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you.
For coming on.
it's been really nice talking to you.
It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much.
And when your memoir comes out, love to have you back.
Oh, thank you.
All right.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Betsy Lerner, author of The Forest for the Trees, an Editor's Advice to Writers, published by Riverhead Books. Okay, next week we have Michael Connelly, mystery author, who will be with us. And if you'd like to be on my weekly email list and receive a post every week of who's coming on, you can email me at writersonwriting@earthlink.net or visit my website at writersonwriting.com. I'd like to leave you with a quote by Barbara Kingsolver, who said, "There is no perfect time to write, there's only now." This is 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine, California. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and thank you for listening.